I'm Edward McNally for the appellant Thomas Crumpler. I reviewed, Your Honors, the transcript of the argument before the three justices and will attempt to improve upon my performance at that time and to focus my argument on the questions that seemed to be of greatest concern to the court then, without meaning in that way to drop some of the points that I may not cover today, but which are in the briefs or I've otherwise tried to cover in my oral argument. There are really four issues on this appeal. What test should apply to a lawyer's conduct that in connection with a Rule 11 issue? Should a lawyer whose honesty is questioned by the court be given a hearing when there's a dispute on the facts? Are the trial court's conclusions about a lawyer's conduct based on evidence in the record and logically drawn from that evidence? And finally, is the sanction imposed appropriate to deter the conduct alleged to have occurred? With respect to the test to be applied, I'm going to be very brief. Mr. Crumpler meets any test that's been applied, either the subjective or the objective test, and I don't know that I need to spend a lot of time dealing with that. I will point out, as the briefs do, that the Superior Court, but for the Abbott case, had previously consistently applied a subjective test, which would require a lawyer to act in good faith. But whatever the test, when a lawyer advances a position, to quote the rule, after an inquiry reasonable under the circumstances, close quote, that he believes is justified, then there is no Rule 11 violation. A lawyer may be wrong, but that doesn't mean he's violated Rule 11. A lawyer may argue a case in a way that the court doesn't particularly think is effective, but that doesn't mean he's violated Rule 11. Most importantly, Rule 11's test applies in the context of an action taken in a case that actually affects how that case is prosecuted. That's what the subclauses 1 and 2 of subsection 11B mean. Now, if we turn to the Inthro Technology case, in discussing...
Well, before you get into that, Mr. McNally, can you spin out the argument in a little bit more detail that even under an objective test, Mr. Crumpler passes?
I'm going to go in great detail on that one. I'll do it because you've asked, I'll do it right now. Under the objective test, the evidence is that he investigated whether there was a big case that supported his client's position. He asked the appropriate people who would know whether or not the case existed. In fact, such a case did exist. He did not make up his citation to the case out of whole cloth. The Obolinsky case stood for the proposition that he advanced in his argument in the county case. He attached the McNulty brief to his brief to show the factual similarities, and under those circumstances, he, in an objective way, honestly believed that what he was advocating was consistent with the law as he understood it. From an objective point of view, since he had support for the position that there was such a case, the fact that he misnamed the case is an error. No question about that. But objectively, his conduct was not designed to impede the administration of the case. It simply was not. Now, with respect to the Avalon case, to answer Justice Jacobs' question directly, there is no requirement that a lawyer cite to adverse authority that has already been cited to the trial court. There's no dispute that the three unreported decisions in the 1990s that were cited by the defendant in the Avalon case were known to the court. They were put right, they were right in the briefs. Mr. Crumpler's response, while unfortunately not mentioning those three cases by name, did in fact cite to the later Supreme Court asbestos case, arguing that that case set the standard. Could he have done a better job in advocacy? Perhaps. But it's not a Rule 11 violation. By any objective standard, there is no case that says the failure to discuss a previously disclosed authority to the trial court is a Rule 11 violation. It simply is not. Now, turning to whether the Rule 11 is even implicated in this case.
Well, help me understand the citing of the wrong case. If your position is that giving the wrong case name is not a violation of Rule 11, is it just because it happened once? If it had happened multiple times, would it cross the line? Or is there no Rule 11 violation whenever a case is miscited?
I think if it happens many, many times, sure there's a Rule 11 violation, Justice Ridgeway, because the lawyer's on notice that his memory is defective and he can't rely upon his memory. It's important to remember here, as was conceded at the last oral argument, that the practice in the asbestos docket in Superior Court was for the lawyers to rely upon their memory as to prior rulings in that court with respect to summary judgment motions. Happened all the time. Therefore, relying on a lawyer's memory, which he has checked out ahead of time, is not a Rule 11 violation. And certainly, if the court believed that that was an inappropriate way to argue cases in the Superior Court, then the remedy for that was to say you can't do that anymore. And if the lawyer had made one mistake and two mistakes and three mistakes, then the court may, at that point, I think reasonably infer that the lawyer has not conducted the appropriate reasonable investigation to determine whether the citation to an unreported, no transcript case is appropriate. But I will once again go back over the facts of this case, which is that the Obolinsky case, which was cited, which was in favor of Mr. Crumpler's client, which he meant to cite, but he cited the McNulty case. That Obolinsky case was decided right before the McNulty case.
I'm sorry, are you telling us that relying on some lawyer's memory is an adequate substitute for legal research?
Of course not. Of course not, Justice Jacobs. It's not an adequate substitute. And that's not what happened here.
I think the you know, if we unless there's an evidentiary problem with the court's finding, the court found that after Mr. Crumpler came back a second time, he did have the correct name of the case because he did a proper job, which is something that should have happened the first time, a fact that seemed to be overlooked in your answer to my first question.
He could have done a better job when he wrote his brief.
It raises serious questions as to whether there was a diligent investigation within the meaning of the rule.
It may raise a question that whether there was a diligent investigation, but remember the circumstances here. The two cases were close in time. Neither case has a transcript. And the reality is that no one lies when the truth advances their position. He certainly was not lying about it because
he's talking about an objective test here.
The question is whether or not the investigation that Mr. Crumpler did was reasonable under the circumstances before he cited that case. That is the issue.
What concerned Judge Abelman is reflected on page 7 of her opinion, where she talks about the representations made, including the identification of McNulty, and the idea that you can rely on the foregoing statements offered by counsel as officers of the court. That really seemed to be something that gave her great concern, that someone would say, rely on my representation as an officer of the court, it's McNulty, and have the wrong case. You would think that before someone put their stake down, their reputation down, you'd get the name right.
Yes, you would. And it's unfortunate that he did not. But every lawyer who signs a pleading, and that's what Rule 11 says, signs that pleading as an officer of the court. It makes no difference if they say, as an officer of the court. They sign it, that's what they're doing. And
well, if that is not a Rule 11 violation, then what, in your view, must the lawyer do in Delaware to violate Rule 11?
He must take action that, in the words of the Intro Technology case, it results in conduct that prejudices the fairness of the proceedings such that it adversely affects the fair and efficient administration of justice.
Well, now, Judge Abelman did talk about that. And, the impact that this one misrepresentation, whether intended or not, had on her workload, which is apparently significant in any event, even if things are going right.
In this case, when this argument had the last time, my opponent said, I think quite correctly, that the miscitation had no effect on the administration of this case. Now, just Judge Abelman certainly went on at great length about the burdens of the asbestos docket and the need for the lawyers to do the best job they can in citing the cases. And that's certainly true. But in this case, there is no Rule 11 violation because it had no effect on her decision. And
okay, so the effect has to be in the individual case. Is that your position?
Yes. And let me back it up by saying that Judge Abelman concluded, the conduct amounts to an attorney's efforts to mislead the court. Court now knows that this attorney's willingness to fabricate is a matter of routine. It's conscious and deliberate conduct. Where is that supported in the record by one instance of a miscitation to a case? Now, we're all human. We can all make a mistake. But those quotes that I've just read to your honors are totally unsupported by the record in this case. And totally, I suggest, unwarranted. Now, I've talked about a little bit about the test that I think the court has to first ask itself. Is the progress of the case been impeded by the lawyer's conduct? If the court concludes it has not, but is concerned somehow that the lawyer's conduct is improper, then that's a matter for disciplinary counsel, not for a Rule 11 sanction. Let me turn now to the issue of whether the hearing was warranted. The factual record is as I've just described it, which is to say that there, in the county case, there was a similar decision that Mr. Crumpler miscited. He, in fact, did an investigation before he cited that case. And if the subjective test applied, he certainly acted honestly. Given all the evidence that he had an honest belief, he was certainly, I think, entitled to a hearing before all the evidence was discounted and the court reached conclusions that he was deliberately lying to the court.
That actually is the remedy that you're seeking on appeal. Is it not, a remand for a hearing?
I would prefer that the decision be vacated and the whole matter be reversed, but it certainly a hearing is the minimum required. Whether it's before, I didn't mean to interrupt, Justice, I apologize. Either before the court or before the disciplinary counsel.
Well, I understand that no hearing was requested by, whichever attorney was representing Mr. Crumpler or Mr. Crumpler himself. Is that correct?
Correct.
If there had been a hearing, what new evidence or fact would have been presented that we don't already have before us and that Judge Abelman didn't have before her?
You know, I don't know that there would have been additional new facts. There certainly would have been a representation by Mr. Crumpler on his own behalf of the investigation that he had done and the questions about whether that was reasonable in the context of the asbestos docket. There could have been 10 minutes worth of testimony from the people he talked to before he cited to that case, saying that, in fact, he did talk to them and was told
about his ability to pay. Is that... would that be an issue? It's a $25,000 assessment here.
Justice Ridgway, that would have been an issue, and it would have been an issue also in the context of Rule 11, where the sanction is supposed to be sufficient to deter repetition of the conduct. Rule 11 doesn't operate as a way in which the court punishes a lawyer. It instead is a way in which the court corrects bad behavior. In this instance, the best way to correct behavior that the court doesn't like is through enforcing the rules, giving people a fair opportunity to be heard, and sticking with the facts that are of record.
Mr. McNally, is there any analogy to be drawn here, at least intellectually, if not precisely, with the court's inherent authority to punish for contempt, and if it occurs instantly in the presence of the court, instant punishment can be held, but on the other hand, if there are facts to be developed to understand the basis for the consideration of a contempt citation, there has to be a hearing. Is there any kind of analogy?
Chief Justice, that's exactly my position. If someone does something in open court, which I've seen once in 40 years, and results in an immediate sanction, there's no dispute about what just happened. Here, on the other hand, given the factual conclusions of the court below, which are, with the exception of a false, incorrect citation to the McNulty case, all of the other factual conclusions about Mr. Crumpler's conduct are simply unsupported. there isn't a history here of past misconduct. There is no history of this having occurred more than once, Justice Ridgeway. Once. Now, either the court is going to provide the kind of a hearing that I'm advocating for, or, which I believe, quite frankly, has worked very well, or we're going to have, quite frankly, fear. That's the two ways to control lawyers. You can scare them to death, which this opinion does, or we can have a hearing where fairness is applied.
A hearing that was not asked for, you know, where you can't identify what new evidence, if any, would be brought out. Correct?
I don't think that's entirely correct. I think at that hearing, they would have been able to draw out that the judge's beliefs concerning Mr. Crumpler's motives, which permeates this opinion, and her beliefs about whether this conduct had ever happened before, all of that would have been brought out, would have been disputed, and she would have understood that she was wrong.
Well, can I follow up on that for a minute? If there were a hearing, could the judge advise your client that in reaching its decision about this particular conduct, the judge is going to want to review with your client a variety of historical events that have perhaps led the judge to the conclusion that she had about motivation and his reliability, or whether he's telling the truth or not, kind of open up background information?
If the judge, yes, Justice Berger, if the judge has other questions like that, they could have been brought up. I might add, this is the second time that Mr. Crumpler appeared before Judge Abel, but in an asbestos case. There is no history here. But if she had concerns, certainly they could have been brought up and would have been rebutted. And we wouldn't have this opinion that we're faced with today, which I will say is simply not supported by the record. Your Honors, I'm going to reserve some time at the end, if I may, please.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Ralph Durstein on behalf of the Superior Court of the State of Delaware. I'd like to accomplish three things here today. One is to confirm that no due process type violation occurred because the trial judge was not obliged to act sua sponte and afford a hearing where none was requested in this case, and where the appellant was afforded a full opportunity to respond and did so in writing. That's all that Rule 11 requires. Secondly, I'd like to encourage this court to adopt what I would call the modern objective standard for enforcement of Rule 11 that has been consistently applied by the Court of Chancery, the Superior Court in this case, and many other courts.
What do you mean by the term modern?
The standard that was applied here by Judge Abelman below reflects an amendment in the federal Rule 11, I believe 1993, that was incorporated in the Superior Court's rule a couple years later. And the language of the rule changed, and that language, which we track in our brief, suggests that the subjective good faith standard is no longer the applicable standard, and instead the court should look to objectively what the lawyer did. In this case, did he make a reasonable inquiry into this case that he cited?
And when you say the modern interpretation, do you mean that it's explicit now in the rule, or do you mean that the rule as changed has been interpreted to say the objective standard is the only standard and the subjective standard's now rejected, regardless of past Delaware case law?
I would argue to the court that the language is explicit, that there was a direct reference to, in effect, good faith in the former rule, and that was removed and replaced by a different standard. But I think that the other aspect is true, too, that where there may be some doubt as to the effect of that language change, the courts have pretty consistently interpreted the change to mean that the good faith standard has been thrown out in favor of the objective inquiry.
And the courts are the Court of Chancery and Superior Court since their rule change?
Well, the Superior Court, it's fair to say, has had a division, even since the rule changed, on the way this rule has been interpreted. The judge below here applied what I would call the modern objective standard. There are other judges that have taken a different view on the Superior Court. This court affirmed in an order a decision of the Superior Court applying the more strict, objective, modern standard, as I call it. And
what is the practical effect of an objective standard at our level? Are we less deferential to a finding by a trial judge because we're looking at it objectively, which requires no real basic fact-finding, beyond the basic fact-finding?
But I would say this court still needs to give great deference to the trial court. This kind of decision is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard, according to the cases. But to answer the question, Justice Ridgway, I do believe that the objective standard may require less scrutiny at this level because there's no longer a need to inquire into motives and the factors that might be considered good faith. That's set aside, and the inquiry is narrowed into what was the conduct, does the conduct, in this case, failing or misciting a case that did not exist, does that hold up to the standard that should be required of Delaware lawyers?
Mr. Durstein, I understand from Mr. Krempler's brief that he's taking the position that the Court of Chancery has uniformly applied the objective test under Rule 11, and the Superior Court had been applying the subjective good faith test until now. I gather you would agree with that, except that you would also argue that some judges, some other Superior Court judges, had also applied in individual cases the objective test.
That's correct, Justice Jacobs. In fact, this judge, Judge Abelman, had previously applied the objective, the stricter standard,
all right,
in a case that's cited in our briefs.
So one of your arguments is that this issue needs to get resolved.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Although it wasn't argued straightforwardly, there seems to be an undertone Mr. Krempler's counsel's argument that although the Superior Court purported to apply an objective test, the findings that were made and the characterizations of Mr. Krempler's conduct suggest that she was actually applying a subjective test. Can you respond to that?
Sure. I read Judge Abelman's opinion, which is very thorough, as considering arguments that were made by Mr. Krempler in the Superior Court, which in effect were good faith arguments. She considered the facts behind that. She rejected that. And I believe the standard that she eventually applied was the objective standard.
So as a factual or evidentiary matter, she rejected the subjective good faith argument.
Well,
but then went on to say that even if there is subjective good faith, there was an objectively speaking, a violation of the rule.
That's correct. Mr. McNally says that Mr. Krempler would pass either test. I think the opinion by Judge Abelman shows he would fail either test. If she had applied the subjective test, he would have failed it because she considered that argument that he made and rejected it. She applied the objective test, and he failed that, and for the reasons that she cites. And one thing, the argument was made that...
It's your position that if in any instance where a lawyer miscites a case, if that's a violation of Rule 11?
No, Justice Ridgway. I think that here is where I would again differ with Mr. McNally. The asbestos litigation where the cases are not only not reported, but not even recorded in terms of a transcript, bench rulings, he argues, in effect, that relaxes the standard. It's understandable somebody might make a mistake. I differ. I believe that where you have a situation where you can't rely on written materials, written reported decisions, you're relying on recollections of bench rulings, that should increase, that should heighten the responsibility of the lawyer in citing that case to accurately reflect and to inquire, either through searching down that transcript or asking another lawyer, as he eventually did, to make 100% sure that that citation is correct. So to answer the court's question, no, Mr. McNally might miscite a case, give the wrong citation or the wrong case name in a brief that we write before the court. If that's a case that is a reported decision or even a decision on Westlaw, that is something that can be tracked down pretty readily. If we're citing
so
something...
that is not a Rule 11 violation in your view?
I don't think in the first instance it would be, no. No. You'd always want to consider the circumstances and the history, but a single isolated violation of getting a citation wrong, a case name wrong, no. But in this instance, where as an officer of the court, a lawyer is reciting what he or she recalls happened in a bench ruling that is nowhere otherwise reflected and can't be seen by the court, it seems to me that that is a heightened duty on the part of the lawyer to make 100% sure that representation as an officer of the court is correct. It's just as if a lawyer represents something outside the record.
We have, basically, under your analysis, then, one set of rules for asbestos cases and another set of rules for other cases?
Well, I would say another set of rules for any representation by a lawyer as an officer of the court that is outside the record, outside the written record. It's not just a bench ruling that's not reflected in any written decision, but any kind of representation about a conversation or something that happened where the court, the judge, cannot see a document or something to verify what happened or did not happen. I would think that any of us would understand when we delve into that area that we had better be darn sure we're getting it correct because there's no way to verify it. We have the ability to verify it, and this lawyer in this case had the ability to go back and eventually was able to do so. The reasonable inquiry should have taken place before the rule to show cause instead of after. That's the problem.
What's the meaning of the info technology case as you see it to the relationship between application by a trial judge of Rule 11 and referral to ODC?
I think that case makes clear that with respect to issues like subjective intent, that's a matter for disciplinary counsel. There's clearly a procedure, a right to a hearing without question on the issue that disciplinary counsel will consider. Rule 11 sanctions are a narrower question, and they relate directly to the functioning of the court and the effect of the misrepresentation on the operation of the court.
And don't you agree? And on whether or not it impedes the progress or the orderly progress of that particular litigation?
That particular litigation, now, again, here is where I would differ.
Differ from what? Different from technology or counsel?
But from counsel. Mr. McNally, I think, argued, if I heard him correctly, that there was no effect on this narrow motion for summary judgment Judge Abelman was considering as a result of the misrepresentation of a case that did not exist. What she said in her opinion at page 21 was, and I quote, counsel's misrepresentation tainted the fairness and efficiency of the adversarial process. I think she was looking at it a little more broadly in terms of the asbestos litigation, the fact that attorneys, Mr. Crumpler and others, would appear before her repeatedly. There was a need to be able to accurately cite these bench rulings that are not reported and to be able to rely on the word of counsel. And if that begins to break down, the whole process.
Can I interrupt on that point in particular? I gather that the two critical cases here that were the one that was miscited was McNulty, whereas the correct case was Opelsinski. And when that case, the Opelsinski case, was finally discovered, plaintiff's counsel suggests that the reason why the confusion arose is because settlement in McNulty prior to summary judgment, realizing that it was very close to the Opelsinski case, which he had previously won. Well, Opelsinski is 2006 and McNulty is 2003, at least according to the citations here. So it seems that that also was something that was wrong about the reliance on these cases. Doesn't that kind of make the point that this system either has to be accurate or it's a morass?
Well, I think it does. And it is somewhat unique to the asbestos litigation, as I understand it. But that, I think, is the point, that the trial judge has to be able to rely on counsel's representations as to matters that may not be in any record. And that seems to me, as I said before, creates a heightened duty on the part of counsel These are attorneys who are involved in all of these cases, or their firms are, and it's reasonable to expect they'd have familiarity with them, and it's also quite reasonable to expect that they might be certain before they cite decisions that can't be verified. Confusion is not completely unavoidable. As a practicing lawyer, I can vouch for that. But in this kind of situation, the argument that was made and the effect of the argument that was made completely disrupted a case before a judge, and is something that could easily have been avoided. And the proof of that is, after the fact, reasonable inquiry resulted in the whole situation being straightened out, and a case that Mr. Crumpler says he meant to cite is identified. What I argue is that could have been done, should have been done, before rule to show cause.
Do you agree that Mr. Crumpler did not violate Rule 11 in the Avalon case by failing to cite adverse authority that was already disclosed in the opening brief?
I don't, Justice Ridgely. It is true, and I concede that there is no rule that requires citation of adverse authority in this instance where the opponent has already cited it. But Judge Abelman's analysis is, these were cases involving same parties, same issue, same law firm, cited by the opponent, ignored in an argument which, taken as a whole, appeared to deny the existence of those cases. Not literally, but that was the effect of it. And again, in the context of the kinds of cases and the lawyers who appeared before her, she felt that that was misleading to the court to not deal with those cases that had been cited.
To what extent does the trial court's decision simply reflect the trial judge's disappointment with the fact that arguably counsel is just not very thorough, not careful, not helping his clients by presenting his cases in the best possible way?
I think it does reflect disappointment and frustration, but I think more than that, the judge wanted to draw a line in terms of what it is reasonable for the trial court to expect in this context, and felt that in this case the lawyer had gone well over the line, doing something that I think anyone would acknowledge is a serious mistake, citing a case by name, a decision that did not in fact exist. I think she felt, the trial judge felt, that this is something that could readily have been corrected, should have been avoided, and amounted to a misrepresentation, and that it was worthy of this sanction because of the effect not just on the case before her, but the effect on the litigation as a whole. And I believe it was reasonable for her, with her assignment and her position and the volume of cases that she had, to reflect upon and comment upon the fact that if the court cannot rely on the word of a lawyer with respect to these decisions, the court cannot continue to function with this volume of litigation and properly dispose of these cases. That was, I think, the point of the frustration and disappointment, but it goes beyond that.
Let me quote from the trial judge's opinion and ask you what your response is to the conclusion she reaches in respect to Rule 11's policy. And I quote, referring to Mr. Crumpler's conduct, she says, at best demonstrates an unjustifiable laziness in carrying out the duties of an attorney, and represents the very misconduct that Rule 11 is intended to address. Did she mean by that Rule 11's intended to address unjustifiable laziness, or that this conduct could be characterized at best as unjustifiable laziness, and that it's other conduct that Rule 11 is intended to address?
Yeah,
I'm confused. The extent to which she believes Rule 11 is intended to address unjustifiable laziness, which may be at gross negligence, let's mm-hmm. say, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. but not bad faith.
Yeah. I would not argue to the court that Rule 11 is intended to address laziness.
I'm not sure there's justifiable laziness, but let's assume that the contrary to unjustifiable laziness is justifiable laziness.
Yeah.
Does it have anything to do with Rule 11 at all, and to what extent do you think it affected her ultimate conclusion?
My reading of that was that there may be instances, and I think this plays into the good faith argument that was made below by Mr. Crumpler, there may be instances of inadvertence, which we might call laziness, or laziness, simple negligence, where a sanction is not warranted. Clearly, this was not that case. This was more serious. The laziness might be me getting a citation wrong in a brief to this court. I hope I wouldn't do that, but I might transpose numbers or confuse a name. That, I would hope, might be simple laziness or negligence. But in this instance, to claim that an unreported bench ruling existed in this name and reached this holding and should be applied in this way in this case went far beyond mere negligence or inadvertence or laziness or a simple error. It was a representation as an officer of the court, first of all. But secondly, it was an attorney vouching for the existence of an opinion which, in fact, did not exist.
But
so,
wasn't it accurate except for the name of the case?
I would not concede that. It did not appear to result in the outcome that Mr. Crumpler was seeking in the case, as I understand it. But it's hard to know exactly what the effect, if the Opelsinski case had been cited originally, how that would have, you know, how the motion would have been resolved at that point by Judge Abelman. It's cited after the fact, and they have to kind of have a redo in terms of that argument. But I would not acknowledge that even the Opelsinski case was on point or properly cited or pertinent. That's a matter, I think, for Judge Abelman. But the original miscitation is what the judge focused on, and properly so, because of the confusion that it caused, and because that goes way beyond the inadvertence or the laziness to a serious misrepresentation that can't be excused. Can't be excused by good faith, can't be excused by eventually after the fact finding a case that may say something like what the case that was cited was purported to say. That's not sufficient. If I may, I just wanted to get to the issue of sanctions. It seems to me that the record below reflects full consideration of all the factors that go into the amount of the sanctions, the type of the sanctions.
Isn't the ability to pay one of the factors that should be considered?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And,
well, what's
and
the record on ability to pay?
This is a judge who is familiar with six-figure settlements in these kinds of cases because she presides over those settlements. So they're matters of record. She is familiar with attorney's fees in those cases and can speak to that. And effectively what this opinion says is a $25,000 sanction would represent a 40% fee in a $62,500 settlement or award in an asbestos case. In the context of the volume of these cases, and they're quite lucrative cases for counsel who work hard and represent their clients, $25,000 is a drop in the bucket. It's a warning to counsel that this is serious conduct and will not be tolerated, but in the context of an attorney with a lucrative practice, it is not a serious impediment
but
to continue.
There's no record of Mr. Crumpler's personal finances or anything of that nature, because he has to pay this personally, right?
That's correct. Yes, Your Honor. Rule 11 says that the sanction ought to be a deterrent to this kind of conduct in the future. And I believe that's what the judge below was aiming for in reaching this number. And she correctly observed that she could not impose a sanction on the other violation because that case had been resolved, and she lacked the power under Rule 11. That was correct. She would have imposed a sanction there, it's clear, but she did not. We believe this sanction should stand as a reasonable warning that this kind of conduct should not be tolerated under these circumstances.
Do you think the trial judge adequately took into consideration reputational damage done by the tone of her opinion and by the findings she made in considering the penalty? Is there a way for us to know, in other words, stated differently, mm-hmm. is there a way for us to know the weight that she gave to reputational damage? Culturally, many of us believe that Delaware lawyers are extraordinarily sensitive to impacts on their reputation, and it's not about the money, mm-hmm. it's about the damage that can be done to a lifetime's work by a single instance where a judge vehemently and strongly disagrees with your conduct and imposes a Rule 11 sanction. Did she address that side of it?
I think she did, Mr. Chief Justice. I would say two things. First of all, it was clear the judge wanted to be very clear and explicit about her disapproval of the conduct and the need for sanctions and the effect on the caseload. I think the second factor operating in the tone of the opinion was that she was very disappointed at the reaction she received from this attorney after the rule to show cause was issued. That initially an associate responded, initially there was an inability to deal with the McNulty-Opelsinski confusion. And so in a succession of responses, she was reacting, I think, to the fact that the lawyer was not sufficiently serious about the rule to show cause and the possible consequences and the type of conduct. The language was strong, in part in reaction as a kind of wake-up call to say, look, the court is concerned about this. A rule to show cause is not to be taken lightly, yet your response is lacking. Your response is not forthcoming. Your response is not fully accepting of the consequences of what you've done. And so I think she responded both to the original conduct and the misrepresentation and to the response, which she felt was deficient and not truly responsive to her concerns. Clearly, that kind of language impacts reputation. I believe she understood that. I believe she felt she needed to use, the court needed to use strong language in order to set a standard.
I believe she did. What I'm looking for is an analysis in the opinion before the sanction was imposed that considers the impact on reputation, weighing that against the dollar amount and the signal to be given to all those in the asbestos litigation arena, so to speak. Because we ask when we review under an abuse of discretion how logical and how factually based the ultimate conclusion may be of the trial judge, and we look for equally reasonable contrary inferences that the facts permit, and that there's a rationale for rejecting them. And here I'm suggesting, for the sake of, not surprisingly, argument, that it's difficult to find a serious consideration of a weighing of reputational damage versus a $25,000 sanction in terms of the adequacy of that monetary sanction.
I would agree that I do not recall any language in the opinion that directly deals with the issue of reputation. What the opinion did do was anchor the sanctions and the comments on the conduct to the rule, the present Rule 11, and to use the language of the rule to justify the sanctions. The language, in a sense, does contemplate reputation and those factors. But whether the judge considered that, I don't think we know from the opinion because it does not appear, you know, in written form.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Justice Berger, I may have either misheard you or I may be confused, but I want to make sure that we've got the dates right. In Appendix A-131 is the Opelsinski argument, which is dated October of 2006. The McNulty case was sometime in the spring of 2007, and that's reflected in A-216 of the appendix. With respect to Justice Jacobs' point, as we pointed out in the brief, there are 17 separate instances in the lower court's opinion where the court concludes that Mr. Crumpler did not deliberately did not tell the truth. I suggest that there are that taints the whole opinion because it's simply not the case. With respect to Rule 11, there isn't a Rule 11 for asbestos cases that says that there should be a heightened level of scrutiny of the lawyer's conduct. The way to address problems such as occurred here is for the court to do, by rule or opinion, that says you cannot cite to unreported decisions without a transcript. just as this court has cured all the problems with deposition conduct by its opinion in the Jamal case, wherever that case was. That's how to address these problems, not with a sanction out of the blue because the trial court is fed up with the asbestos docket. That's what happened here. That's not fair.
Well, is it fair to say that this was done just because the judge was fed up with the asbestos docket? This lawyer said, I think literally to the judge, I'm giving you this, I'm citing this as an officer of the court with all of the solemnity that that phrase carries with it, and it turned out to be wrong. Now, in those circumstances, you know, does that not justify some ire on the part of the court where what's being cited is not in the record and there's no way to determine whether it's right or wrong without relying?
Well, it certainly is a way to determine it's right or wrong. The defense counsel immediately pointed out that the McNulty case did not result in a favorable decision. And in fact, what's wrong here is that the name is wrong. If Mr. Crumpler had cited to the McNulty case and there was no Apolinsky case, okay, this would be a different case altogether.
Okay, that's fair enough. But this wasn't just a citation, a shot from the hip, but a shot from the hip with the message that you can trust me, you know, I'm an officer of the court.
Justice Jacobs, every time I'm in court, I'm on the line. Everything I say as a fact matter, I have to believe is a fact. Whether I say it's an officer of the court or I don't even mention that, that's my obligation. Sure, he used those language, but that doesn't mean he was trying to trick the trial court. That's just, I had to say it, a little bit of rhetoric, but that's every lawyer's got that responsibility. I can't say something to a judge in the Superior Court that I think is false, and I can't do that.
I wasn't suggesting that by using that language he was trying to trick the court. I was suggesting that he was trying to induce the court to have confidence in what he said without further investigation.
Justice Jacobs, I think you're right. I think he was arguing his case. And when it comes to sanctioning lawyers because of the way they argue their case, putting aside the error here, we're in big trouble.
Well, Mr. McNally, let's put aside laziness and put aside being untruthful. You were talking about the number of times the court commented on whatever we want to call what Mr. Crumpler was doing. But what I like to call it for purpose of this question is simply not being precise. If you're an officer of the court and you repeatedly take a cavalier attitude that reflects a lack of precision, at what point in time will that lack of precision justify concern by the court?
If it happens twice, that's my standard. Every human being's entitled to an error. You do it twice, you haven't learned from the first time. Second time you do it, you haven't learned, you have to be sanctioned, but not the first time. I'm not here arguing for a low standard, believe me. I'm arguing for a high standard, but one that's fairly applied based on the facts, not one that's applied because the trial court is, quite frankly, overburdened. This is a judge who's trying to do her very, very best. And it's frustrating to be the trial judge in an asbestos case, but that doesn't mean a sanction is warranted in this case.
One free pass without attempting to cast aspersions on the way you characterized it. Under Rule 11, there should be one free pass if there's an inaccurate citation.
There should be one free pass when the lawyer is able to demonstrate that he made an inquiry that he thought was reasonable, unless it shows that he didn't make that reasonable inquiry. Here, the only evidence is he made an inquiry, and he thought it was reasonable, and I think under those circumstances, given the way the asbestos docket worked, a high-speed docket, under all the circumstances, I think it was reasonable.
Was it objectively reasonable?
Yes. I think it was objectively reasonable for two reasons. The first is that it's based on some facts, which is that there was the Opalinsky case. There was a case that he was trying to say was factually similar and where the plaintiff prevailed on a summary judgment motion.
So long as that's there, and his assurance by his colleagues that it was instead the McNulty case, then I think it is objectively reasonable. If the Obolensky case didn't exist, this would be a different case. But because it does,
going to an area of the law that you practice infrequently, your focus seems to be on the merits of the legal proposition and not the name. So the analogy would be, a lawyer says to the Court of Chancery, if you'd like to know the fiduciary duties of a board of directors in selling a company, they're well laid out by the Delaware Supreme Court. Here's what they are, and you'll find them in Unocal. So everything's right, except he said Unocal rather than Revlon. And you're saying the focus should have been on the substance and not the miscitation.
For purposes of a Rule 11, yes, Justice Holland, yes. That's what saves this my client's position in this case. He had a basis to make the statement. He just made a mistake. My time is up, and I really don't have anything else that I think I need to say in rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.